Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Spotlight on Youth. My name is Rebecca Ballard DiLoretto, and I will be guest hosting this edition of Spotlight on Youth, a program dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center Incorporated, a not-for-profit children's rights legal organization. The radio show is being streamed live over the web and will be available on demand after its conclusion. Please participate in the show by asking questions. To do so, you may dial 347-994-1149 and press 1 to be placed into the queue, at which point your call will be screened by our assistant. Again, that number is 347-994-1149. You can also submit questions via the chat room if you are so inclined. Joining us today are three individuals: Tim Arnold from the Department of Public Advocacy, Kate Templin from Gateway Juvenile Services, and a mom of a child who has been in the juvenile justice system on a status offense. So we'd like to begin our conversation this afternoon with Tim. Tim, could you share with everyone, I know that you come to this work having been a lawyer for children for a number of years, right?
That's right. I am the post-trial division director at the state's Department of Public Advocacy. That's the state public defender office. I've been working with kids since about 1996. Both status offenders who we're talking about today and public offenders who are in youth who have committed criminal offenses.
Okay, thank you. And could you share with our audience what a status offense is?
A status offense is an act of misbehavior by a child that would not be a crime if it was committed by an adult, but which nevertheless is a problem when it's committed by a child. So examples of that would be truancy. As an adult, you're not required to go to school. So if you don't go to school, that's not a violation of any kind. Beyond control of parent, beyond control of school, things of that nature are characterized as status offenses in Kentucky.
And what are the concerns that are in conversation, public dialogue today about how Kentucky ranks in its treatment of children charged with status offenses?
Kentucky ranks second in the country in terms of the utilization of detention for status offenses. Second is not a good thing in this context. We use it too much. So other than Washington, I think Washington State is the only jurisdiction in the country that has a higher level of status offenders in detention centers than Kentucky. And that's a problem because, you know, there is both federal money attached in because it's you know, the act of detaining a status offender is really pretty harmful to the child who is being detained.
When, you know, you think about the term detention, you kind of think about after-school detention and, you know, that type of thing. Can you describe for our listeners what you mean when you use that word and where this kind of detention occurs?
Kentucky has what's called a statewide system of detention, and it is, so there are detention centers, which are jails. In every possible respect you can think of a jail, these are jails. Your access is controlled through doors. Those doors only open and close when a central office opens or closes them. And those jails are located at various points throughout the state, and all of the counties feed into those jails. So if a status offender is being detained, or securely detained, what that means is that they are being placed into one of these juvenile jails, and typically they're going to be in that jail. Those jails are not simply status offenders. Those are also going to be public offenders who are kids who have been charged with a crime who are being tried in juvenile court, and youthful offenders, kids who have been charged with a crime that's so serious that they're being tried as an adult. If they're under 18, they'll also be in the juvenile detention center.
And what courts in Kentucky process status offenders? Like, how does such a case begin in the court system?
what happens is if you, you know, a case, a status offense case begins when somebody, either it's a school official or a parent, submits a petition with a court-designated worker. The court-designated worker is a, sort of a body of the court that is designed to try, to the extent possible, to keep juvenile cases out of court. They're looking for diversions, things that they can do with a child that doesn't involve them coming through the court process. So when somebody comes in and submits a petition, in some area, particularly in some jurisdictions, the court-designated worker may be required by the judge to file that as a formal petition with the court. Then that court is going, typically it's either going to be, you know, most jurisdictions now have access to a family court, and in those cases, those places with a family court, it's the family court that will be hearing those that case. In those jurisdictions that do not have a family court, it'll be the district court, which is the lowest level of court, which will be hearing that case. And those, you know, that district or family court judge will then be, you know, considering the petition before them and trying to address the issues that have been that relate to it.
Thank you. Kay, I wanted to ask you, how many years have you been involved with this issue of status offenders in Kentucky?
Well, I began my work with status offenders in 1987 when I started work at a small private nonprofit agency called Gateway Juvenile Diversion Project. So I've been involved. But prior to that, I was involved to some extent through work with DCBS for a couple of years. So almost half my life, I guess it's safe to say, Rebecca.
So I guess the issue of whether of making children go to school has probably been with us at least that long, right?
Yes, it has. It seems that truancy is, I think, according to some numbers that I've seen recently, truancy charges, truancy petitions, far outweigh any other petition that is filed in the state of Kentucky. I think almost 6,000 truancy petitions were filed last year in Kentucky. So it gives you an idea of the magnitude of that issue, perhaps.
And what kind of role does Gateway, you're now called Gateway Children's Services, is that correct?
That's right. We did change our name.
And in what way is your organization involved with children who are charged with status offenses?
We came about, interestingly enough, back in 1981 as a result of some litigation that was filed in Kentucky by Kentucky Youth Advocates, I believe. They filed a class action suit on behalf of, I believe it was 8 children, who had been illegally placed in adult jails with adult prisoners. And that lawsuit was one of those that touched a lot of people across the state of Kentucky and was probably never fully settled. But an outgrowth of that litigation was the establishment of this project, Gateway Juvenile Diversion Project, it was called. It was a national model, and we began the work here with a small emergency shelter with the mission statement of an alternative to jail for children. And that is exactly what we did. We worked in 7 counties. As I said, we had 8 beds. We have expanded tremendously from those early days, but yet even today, that is still our mission. And we've added a treatment program. We have a lot of additional services, and we're nationally accredited. And instead of just 7 counties, we serve children from all across the state of Kentucky.
I want to move us back for a second, Kay, to what Tim said. Tim said we're number 2 in the country in our incarceration of children on status offenses. And have you worked on that issue at the national level? Are you on a committee that's been designed to address that?
Yes, I am. As I think I said earlier today, I like it when I hear my Kentucky basketball team is number 1 or number 2, but when I sit in a room in Washington, D.C., and introduce myself as being the representative from Kentucky and learn that my state is ranked 2nd in the nation in this category, it's disconcerting, to say the least. I serve on the Juvenile Justice Advisory Board and have since since its inception in 1996, and have served as chairman of that group for a time and am currently vice chairman. As a part of that work, I represented Kentucky at the federal level with the Coalition for Juvenile Justice. And this is an agency that is made up of representation from all 50 states and 5 territories. And as a part of that work, an advisory committee has been launched last year, the Deinstitutionalization of Status Offenders, the DSO Project, and I was asked to serve on that. And it's taking a look at this issue all across the country. It's what's working and what is not working, ways to find support for the projects that are working, and things of that nature.
And you indicated the Juvenile Justice Advisory Board is a statewide organization kind of devoted to all kinds of juvenile justice issues. Would that be fair to say?
That's true, yes.
When you look at your work at Gateway with status offenders, what kind of role does assessment play in your work with youth? And can you help everybody understand what an assessment is in your estimation?
Well, I think assessment is the most vital role, the most vital point in looking at status offenders, particularly truancy, because I've said in the past there are almost as many causes, root problems, causing something like truancy as there are children. And as such, a true assessment needs to be done on the front end. And that assessment can take different forms, but I feel like that the assessment piece that we do here at Gateway Children's Services is exceptional, because teenagers by their nature are rather guarded and protective of their, they're not trusting necessarily. And so I think a true assessment needs some degree of a relationship established. And I think a part of that assessment includes a look at the medical, dental, vision problems. These are huge contributors that we've found to the problem of truancy. Children with significant dental issues, vision issues, medical issues that are preventing them from going to school, or if they do go to school, they're failing or falling behind, or they're the target of bullying, or all things that contribute to their not wanting to go to school. So that is a very important part of an assessment. Beyond that, the assessment that we do at Gateway includes an assessment of their schoolwork and where they are in school, because we have our own school here. And some real learning takes place in our classroom. We had 96 credits were earned last year here in our little one-room school at Gateway. It's very important to see if the child has been placed in the appropriate educational setting. We find many, many children who have not been appropriately diagnosed or haven't even been diagnosed at all and should, in fact, be in special education or all sorts of educational issues, and our school, our classroom, and our agency does a very effective job with that piece as well.
We also have a mom with us, and you know, I wonder if mom, you're from a more rural community in Kentucky, and you've had some experiences that your son has struggled through with being charged with truancy. Is that right?
That's correct.
And
yes.
I was wondering, in terms of your child's experience with the court-designated workers office or the court system, did the kind of assessment by the school occur for your son to try to meet his needs before anything was brought to court?
To my knowledge, there was no assessment of any kind. The diversion program, in my words, I think it was a joke. I mean, all it was meeting at the school, like on Friday mornings, I think it was, for 30 minutes, and it was more or less just a check-in thing. You had to bring your grades, you know, all week, showing how you'd done all week in your classes, and that was basically it. There was nobody ever came to, you know, my child or myself and tried to assess him, although I went to them and said, you know, he is being treated for depression. He was even hospitalized with depression. None of that was taken into consideration, and it just kept going forward until he ended up in detention.
So was his depression a factor that impacted his school attendance?
Yes, definitely. Definitely, and not just his school attendance. I mean, it was, you know, doing things with his friends, doing things with his family, going to church. I mean, it wasn't just school. And, you know, and I feel that the court-designated worker, the DPP, everyone was aware of this, but it just didn't seem to make any difference. I think with the law being the way it is, that it's being very misused.
When you, you know, I could you share a little bit, I mean, when, you know, some people, some listeners might say, well, we might all get depressed at different points. I mean, are you talking, when you speak of that, of, you know, an identified, you know, mental health issue for your child?
Yes, yes. I mean, he was actually hospitalized with clinical depression for 3 weeks. Treated, still is being treated with antidepressants, still sees a therapist. So, I mean, yes, he was diagnosed and treated by a health professional. It wasn't just something he was saying. It was, you know, I mean, he's been diagnosed by actually about 3 different doctors. And so there wasn't any iffiness about it. You know, they knew that there was medical evidence to back up that he, you know, had this depression problem, and he wasn't skipping school and out running around, you know, playing or getting into trouble. In fact, he's never been in any kind of trouble, never even been sent to the principal's office during his whole high school career, and he's a senior, never been sent, you know, for anything. This is the only problem that I've had with him whatsoever is the truancy. And you know, and like I said, he has the medical diagnosis, and they were aware of that, and they didn't do any kind of assessment, and let alone listen to me when I tried to, you know, talk to them and keep him out of detention.
Uh-huh. And so did he, you know, in a sense, plead guilty to this status charge, this truancy charge, when he was in court?
Well, we had a court-appointed attorney. We wasn't even told you could plead not guilty or to plead guilty. I never remember that issue even being brought up. It was just we went in front of the judge, the court-designated worker, and the person from the county attorney's office were on one side of the courtroom. Me, my son, and his attorney was on another side of the courtroom, and basically they were just pushing for this detention, although his attorney was saying, look, here's colleges that's accepted him, he's passing, he's never been in any kind of trouble, why would you want to detain a child like this, especially with his medical background? But it didn't make any difference. I mean, the judge pretty much does whatever the court-designated worker wants to do, you know, and I'm finding that, or I'm hearing that from other parents in other, you know, counties in Kentucky. So there was no pleading guilty or not guilty, to my knowledge.
You didn't have that sense of it. Tim, can you share a little bit about what the law is on in terms of status offenders, and like when mom's, you know, son ended up, when it was likely in process that her child ended up before the court facing the possibility of detention?
Sure. The, you know, the process, how the process is, you know, sort of expected to look, and how it, which isn't always how it does look, is that, you know, you may go through the CDW's office and then be referred to court. When you are referred to court, you'll have to, you know, there's a summons that's issued. The child is brought before the court. The court may enter at that time. Under the present law, the court, it's sort of a kind of a crazy system, because the court can enter an order at arraignment and never have to actually find the child guilty of the status offense. So you've been charged with it, but that's all that means is that there's a petition that sets out that you did something. That doesn't mean you've been proved guilty. So you get brought in for your arraignment, and it's going to look like arraignment in a criminal case. So you're going to, the judge is going to ask you, should be asking you, excuse me, about whether or not you wish to have an attorney, about what the, do you understand the charges? Do you, things of that nature. Typically one would prefer to enter a plea of not guilty and have an opportunity to speak to the attorney so that the attorney can speak, you can speak with a lawyer and get good advice about whether or not you have a defense to the charge, because oftentimes you do. The statutes are not written to be broad. And so a lot of, there are circumstances where even if somebody is accused of truancy, if they're accused of truancy because they've missed a certain number of schools and they're out for a medical reason, for example, those absences maybe should have been excused. And so one can, if you're telling your lawyer that, that becomes a defense. So after that point, the court may enter an order at that time. If the court enters an order and the child violates the order at any time thereafter, the child can be held in contempt and sent to jail. If, what ought to happen is the court should be setting it for a adjudication, which is the, the terminology for the trial in the case. And either at that adjudication hearing, either the child should be pleading guilty, would plead guilty, which is in the juvenile world called an admission. Basically, they're saying, I did the offense. Or they will go to trial, and they have the right to call witnesses on their behalf. They have, the court has to find them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt or not at all. All of that. At the conclusion of that, if the court has found them guilty, either because they admitted or because the trial that was the result of the trial, the there is a disposition hearing, at which point the court can determine what the appropriate solution for the child's issue is. And the idea is that the court in that moment is supposed to be investigating what is best for the child and coming up with a program that's supposed to help the child to improve. What I think is occurring sometimes in status offense cases is the court isn't really doing that. There isn't quite the same, it may be because of lack of awareness of resources, it may be for other reasons, but what's happening is the court is relying instead on this order that they've entered, that's told the child to be good. And if the, basically they're threatening the child that if the child doesn't behave, I'll put you in jail. And that's, that it varies greatly by jurisdiction, but in some jurisdictions that occurs fairly frequently, and that is the only thing that, that really happens as a result of the case. There is no programming or treatment or anything else that's offered to the child to help them to improve their behavior. So that's, I don't know if that answers your question completely or not, but
sure.
That's sort of a rundown of the process.
And that, in the end, sometimes it, you see in cases that maybe the only thing that is happening in court is this threat of the potential of jail time. Is that fair to say?
That, like I said, it varies greatly by jurisdiction.
Right.
But there, yes, there are certainly jurisdictions where I think that the principal tool that is being used is to threaten to send the kid to jail if he doesn't behave, or she doesn't.
One of the things we found in looking at this issue is that some schools say that they need this stick of, jail to motivate children to attend school. Mom, I wondered, did that motivate your child, the fear that he would go to jail? Did that, back when that order was put in place for him, did that make him...
Before he actually went?
Right. Uh-huh. Did that motivate him to...
No, it didn't change anything because his problem was from depression. So, and also, I was a firm believer before this happened that we lived in a free country that would not go to your school and arrest and handcuff your child and take them to jail. I believed that with all my heart. And
is that what happened
course,
to your son?
That's exactly what happened to him.
They went to school and they handcuffed him in school?
Yes. They handcuffed him at school, put him in the back of a police car, took him to jail. He sat up there about 4 or 5 hours. They had him to text message me and tell me he was in jail. This is
so no adult called
so
you?
Inappropriately.
Yeah, no adult called you to tell you this had happened?
No.
The school didn't call you to tell you?
No, the school didn't call me. Nobody did.
Was your child failing his classes?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, Mom. What'd you say?
I was just so blown away by this, and I know he didn't think anything like that would happen either because, You know, like I said, he had never been in any other trouble. In fact, when this happened, as a mother, the first thing I thought, well, maybe there's something that he's not telling me. So one of the very first things I did was, you know, ask, talk to the school, talk to, you know, is there something going on here? I don't know. It's just against the law to miss school, you know. And I'm like, you know, well, you know he's had this depression and you know that he's got doctor's excuses for the days he missed. They wouldn't accept one of the doctor's excuses is actually why that he ended up being arrested and taken, because they made a decision not to accept one of the doctor's excuses. So I think that's why he never felt really threatened by it, and it wouldn't have made any difference, I don't think, if he would have, because he couldn't control the depression that he was having. It's just simply the detention thing has done nothing but made things harder for him. It's made things harder for me. He's went back in his depression a little bit. I've seen his self-esteem go downhill. Now he is struggling in school, and he wasn't before. I've seen it have a very negative effect on him. I've seen it have an effect on him that there's one of his classmates that was arrested on school property during school hours of selling marijuana and never spent 1 hour behind bars. But yet he, that's never broken any laws, but, you know, the truancy thing, has, you know, spent a lot of time behind bars. So, you know, I can see how that's very discouraging to him.
Now, your child, he's a senior, you indicated. So
that's
obviously he advanced from his junior to his senior year, even though he had the truancy issues, right?
Yes.
So was he, before he was, you know, most recently put in jail, was he failing in school?
No, he's never failed. He's had a couple of classes during his high school that he's not passed, but nothing that's held him back from one year to another. He's, you know, actually done pretty well in school. And like I said,
is he going to go to college? Or
he's already got accepted to two colleges, and then he has another college that is talking to him almost on a daily basis that wants him in their music program, and they're trying to, you know, push him to make sure he gets this paper turned in or that paper turned in or his FAFSA filled out or whatever, you know, because that's so at the third college that's looking at him right now. So, you know, despite all this, I feel like he's done really well.
So he went to jail even though he had already been admitted to two colleges and was,
yes,
I mean,
and
you know, performing in school.
Yes, and the judge was told that, and the judge even said, you're a good student, you're a good kid, you got to go to school. You know, the judge knew, and I felt like the judge was a little bit reluctant, but you got your county attorney's office and the DPP and the court-designated worker all, you know, saying, you know, this has got, you know, he's got to go to juvie, he's got to go to juvie. And I really felt like the judge reluctantly sentenced him to juvie because of being pushed so hard on that side. And then, of course, we had a court designate, not a court, but a court-appointed attorney. And I know she's probably overwhelmed, has so many cases. I just feel like, you know, that may have affected a little bit. I knew very little about it at the time. I've educated myself a little bit about the laws now. But, yeah, basically that's what happened. I mean, he hadn't been in any kind of trouble. And he still has the depression, and actually he has it worse a little bit since this has happened. We just felt totally helpless. It's made my life as a single mom very, very, it's made things really, really hard for me. And I wish we could get some of the laws changed here.
I want to follow up on that, the laws changed, and we can, Tim can maybe talk about that a bit. But Kay, could you first speak to how your program might be different than the locked incarceration that mom's child experienced?
Yes. I've often said status offenders are the children who fall through the cracks in the system, and they're either treated inappropriately, as this young man certainly seems was, or not at all. But some of the lucky ones land at Gateway Children's Services, And even though the children may refer to us as juvie as well, because their freedoms are restricted to some degree, we have a very structured program, but there are no bars, there are no cells, there's no kind of physical restraints done at all here, which is interesting because we keep children who have been incorrigible in school and at home without ever touching them. Our facility operates on a system of rules, a lot of rules, and a lot of structure, because I think it's important that children learn to be accountable. But none of these kinds of harsh treatment here at all, none of this. We don't do, there's strip searches are done at those secure facilities. We do nothing like that here. We do are very concerned about the children's safety. Quite often their safety from themselves, because we see a lot of children suffering from depression. So we take certain steps to ensure that they are safe from themselves. And we have case managers and counselors and therapists who are available, who are here 24 hours a day for assessments as well as for counseling for the children.
That sounds like an excellent program. Tim, is there any legislative effort afoot? Mom had mentioned she wished that the laws would change. Is there an effort that's out there?
Yes. Today, the House Judiciary Committee passed House Bill 123, which is a bill that's been sponsored by Representative Flood in Lexington, that is it includes provisions that would restrict the length of time that valid court orders, these orders that courts are entering, can be in effect. It will restrict the types of cases that the court can accept as a status offense by requiring certain information to be provided, and that would change the process for holding a child in contempt and ensure that courts are aware of the fact that they don't have to put somebody in jail even if the child is in contempt. I mean, the thing that strikes me most about Mom's story is, her child was in school and was removed from school so to punish them for having failed to be at school at some previous time. That is not, if what we want is, as a society, is to push sort of the value of making sure that children are in school, and I certainly support children being in school. My child, I grew up in a family of teachers. We shouldn't, I think that the idea should be that we're encouraging them to be there more, not that we are removing them to take them to the detention center. And, that's, I think that many courts today, I believe, think that they don't have much of a choice if a child has violated the order, but to remove the child from, to put the child in detention. And so this statute would help make sure that that's clear, that they always are going to have that choice and that they're given good information to help them make the choice better. The other things that have changed is recently the court adopted a new set of court rules for family court. They include rules related to status offenders that I think adopt some of the better practices that have been in various places throughout the state. So they're intended to restrict, discourage the use of court orders as a resolution to, try to get more information to the court to make decisions and to have the court process the case more along the lines of trying to identify a treatment solution than a incarceration solution.
Well, Tim, if the listeners were interested in following up on this kind of work, do you know where they might go to find out about the status of the bill?
LRC's website is very good. If you went to it's www.lrc.ky.gov. And if you went there and you looked at the legislative record for 2011, it is House Bill 123. If you click through there, you'll eventually get to it. And that'll tell you all the information about the present status of the bill. It usually updates about 24 hours after anything's done. If you wish to do something to support the bill and you want to call your legislator and say, I support House Bill 123 and I would like it to be passed, the number to call is 502-564-8100. And you can ask for your legislator.
502-564-8100?
8100. And you can either give a generalized message of support, which will go into they'll keep a tally of these things, Or the more effective way is to, you know, if you go on the website, you can identify who your individual legislator is, if you don't know, and to ask us to leave a message for your legislator. And the message should be something along the lines of, I support House Bill 123, which will reduce the use of status offenders in Kentucky, save Kentuckians money, and provide better treatment for children.
And as I'm aware of it, this particular bill is part of Kentucky's blueprint for children, along with other issues, you know, involving related to children's health. And certainly, just as you've described, Mom, this certainly is very intricate to your child's health. And as Kay described, a lot of, if you have an accurate assessment, you may end up addressing the issues, might be dental or vision or you know, mental health or the need for food in the home. And if you are able to meet those needs, then you might be able to help the child attend school. I know that that group, the Blueprint for Kentucky's Children, is meeting in Frankfort all day on February 17th. And that Kentucky Youth Advocates website, you can sign up for that if you wanted to be a part of it, or you could just show up in Frankfort on the 17th. I mean, do legislators really listen to those who call in, Kay? What's your experience in terms of what they might listen to?
Well, I always preface my remarks about that sort of issue around the fact that children don't vote, and children don't necessarily make us a lot of money. And so they sometimes, very easy for them to fall to the bottom of the barrel. However, there are those of us who need to be their voice. And I know a lot of people give lip service to children's issues. But I have found that when legislators receive calls from a wide variety of people, that, yes, indeed, they do listen. They've listened to me through the years, and they've responded through the years. In fact, I think you might find them to be more open than many people would expect. It's important to remember that legislators are pulled in many, many directions during the legislative session, and every single person who is talking to them thinks that their issue is the only issue and the most important one. So it's important to go into those conversations with that in mind, not to back down, because these children need a voice. They don't have a voice, and we have to be their voice. So I've had a positive relationship with legislators through the years.
I know that some of our listeners have asked if I would repeat the phone number they need to call in to ask a question, and that number is 347-994-1149. So, Kay, what you seem to be suggesting is, as adults, we have an obligation to try to speak for the children, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to point out things like this, and just like the mom story there, unless this has happened to you, there are many, many good people out there who really have no idea that things that are as draconian as this are going on right now, today, right here in their own communities. So, yes, it's important that we give a voice to these issues.
Yeah. Kay, is there sort of a national way to solve this problem, or is it one that we do have to solve at this state level and at the community level?
That's an interesting question. I know one of the first things that you encounter when you start working on juvenile issues, children's issues at the federal level, is that we can't even seem to decide what a child is. We can't agree on that, because in Kentucky, certainly, you're a child if you're under the age of 18, but there are at least 10 states where that's not true. Children become adults in North Carolina, in New York, in Louisiana, as young as 15, 16, 17. So you have to preface any look at a national level around those kinds of issues, because the fiscal impact on a state is rather dramatic, and some of these states are taking a serious look now at raising the age, but most of them aren't going past 17. So just having said that, I know it's just important. This really is a community issue, a state issue, I really think, but built around the parameters of from a federal aspect. And it's very important to learn what other states are doing. I know in this committee work we learned, I think Pennsylvania was proposing legislation to put the parents in jail if their children were truant, with apparently no look at the situation. Again, that assessment piece wasn't a part of it, to my knowledge. And so it's important we can learn from the successes of others as well as perhaps some things that have not been successful. So it's important that we have a dialogue on a federal level, certainly. But it's not a one-size-fits-all issue, I guess is one of my points.
Uh-huh. And I don't know, you know, when you think about this, what Mom has shared with us, certainly you think about, and she described herself as a single parent, you know, locking her up.
Exactly.
In that circumstance would have just been a devastating reaction, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Just, you know, a knee-jerk reaction that really horrendous, frankly.
Mom, I'm sure, I mean, this had to be very, I can't imagine being locked up in handcuffs at school. I mean, your child probably didn't know if others thought he murdered somebody, you know, because they don't, I mean, you know, if a police officer stops his, you know, they were to take somebody in, they don't, you know, handcuffing them in a public place is a frightening experience, right?
Yes, absolutely, and he didn't know why he was being taken in. I mean, he knew of nothing that he had done. He didn't find out until he got there. I mean, of course, at first he thought, you know, that it was some kind of mistake, you know, because he knew he hadn't done anything bad enough to be, you know, handcuffed and put in a police car and taken to jail and locked up. But then, of course, you know, the court-designated worker came in and talked to him, and then he realized it was for truancy. But I would like to say, if I may, for anybody that might be listening and think, well, you know, if your kid doesn't go to school, then they know they might get locked up. I'd just like to say, I think every situation is individual. It's very horrifying that my son was taken to a jail. He was strip searched. He was incarcerated with children that were, you know, his age, older, younger, you know. Some were in there for crimes, you know. It was a very scary thing for him. And to take our children and lock them up for things like truancy, I just like for you to try to imagine what that would feel like if you were in that situation, especially if it's a situation where your child truly had, what if it was diabetes, you know, or something that you could physically see, just because it's something like depression, or if it's ADHD, you know, he was diagnosed with that when he was a little small child. You know, I'd just like for anybody that thinks, because I used to think differently about this, Rebecca, than I do now. You know, I used to think, well, if you don't go to, you know, school, you could go to jail. And then till I was faced with what could happen when you really do have a good child, you have an intelligent child, and they're really trying hard, but you see them suffering something that's beyond their control, and then they end up in jail for it, it makes you stop and look at this totally different. And it's definitely changed his life. It's changed my life. And I would just like to see, you know, this law get passed to, you know, prevent, he's my last kid at home, but I don't want to see anybody else go through what we've been through.
And it sounds to me like, as you describe your situation, you have tried to be a very good parent to him.
I gave a job to because of, I had so much fear put in me. My fear really wasn't him being incarcerated. I just was kind of ignorant about the whole situation. But I was made at one point to feel like I was working a lot of hours, and I was kind of made to feel like, in a nonchalant sort of way by one of the court people, that, you know, if you're so tied up with your job, you know, and your kid's missing school, you know, they could put your child in foster care. So I actually quit my job to so I could be there for my child. As you know, I felt kind of guilty as a mom that I wasn't doing enough, and you know, we've really struggled financially since then. I feel like if I hadn't have been there as much as I had for him, I don't know where he would be with all of this. You know, I feel like my encouragement has surely helped him. He says that if it wasn't for me, he don't think he would have survived everything that has happened, and I hope that I've been able to help him. But I just think that, you know, the court system, the laws need to look at, first of all, look at the parent, and, you know, are they – have they proven their involvement and their concern with their children? They're not just turning them loose. I never did that. I always was, you know, probably overly concerned about my children because I'm a kind of an overprotective parent. But then, you know, secondly, I feel like together, you know, if they want to have a, some kind of program to help the children, then work with the parent to get to the root of the problem and work with you, not against you. And then, you know, implement an effective plan of action based on that child's individual needs, you know, rather than set out to be like this big punishment thing for the whole family.
Wow. So our idea that, you know, our family courts and our juvenile court system, that it's there to help and empower the family, that wasn't your experience. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say.
Tim, from you've represented children around the state.
That's right.
Across the whole state, pretty much. Can
yeah.
you kind of describe what your experience has been in terms of attorney time and parent time and, you know, judge's time on this issue, you know, of status offenders in the court arena?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that, honestly, if they're doing it well, you know, what's happening is, you know, that means they're probably are, the court is attempting to encourage diversion for as many cases as can be diverted and only taking those cases that are the most serious, but then they're spending a lot of time on those cases, if they're doing it well. What I think is occurring in those jurisdictions which are not perhaps doing it as well is that they are not spending very much time at all on the case initially, and then they're spending a lot of time is then going to be expended by everybody, the attorney, the judge, everybody on the contempt.
Yes.
So basically what's going to end up happening is all of the resources end up getting thrown into the back end after this has not worked.
Uh-huh.
And responding to the consequence of it not working. And the fact is, you know, it wasn't going to work most of the time. I mean, you know, ordering a child to behave if the child is troubled is not a terribly effective approach to it. Even leaving aside the harm it could do to the child, even if it was harmless, it's not going to work a lot of the time. I mean, there are people who it'll work on. My wife and I had a conversation the other day about our daughter, and that was when I learned that she had never been sent to the principal's office in her entire life. And I didn't think people like that existed. I'm pretty sure for her, if she got threatened with jail, she would conform whatever she needed to do. But for the rest of us, maybe not as much. And certainly for people who are dealing with other things, it's the other thing that's causing the bad behavior. You know, for mom's child, you know, what we've been hearing about is that, you know, he was dealing with depression and other things. And it really wasn't bad behavior at all. He was getting treatment. But that even if there was any bad, to the extent that there would be any element of bad behavior, it was, you know, it was really more, had much more to do with depression than any resistance to the authority of the state to send him to school. So ordering the child to conform their conduct to the requirements of the court's orders is really not, in that context, is not going to be helpful. If we aren't dealing with the underlying issue, then that child is always going to be coming back with a violation. And when they come back with a violation, that's when people are going to be spending the time. So I don't know that changing the law is necessarily going to save anybody some time, but I think it will certainly redirect the time towards more productive purposes, because if you spend time with the child and try to identify what they're dealing with, you can come up with solutions that are going to be much more effective in the long run for that child, and hopefully keep them from having to be in jail.
Tim, has there been any indication like that the Kentucky, you know, the highest court in Kentucky has a concern about this issue? The Kentucky Supreme Court?
The Kentucky certainly the Kentucky Court of Appeals, which is sort of the first court of first resort for appeals from family court, have rendered a number of opinions that are that indicate that they have a concern for where things are at. The court,
and then are there some rules that the Supreme Court's passed?
The Supreme Court, and then as we were discussing earlier, there's the rules changes have occurred recently from the Kentucky Supreme Court, and those are in some attempting to implement standardized procedures to deal with a lot of these issues. Because a lot of the issue is that there's no sort of rule book for how you're supposed to deal with a status offense case, and every court does it differently. And so some of the better practices are incorporated into the rules. I think the rules are a start. They could go further, and we're hoping to help them to go further in future years. But the Supreme Court's rule, I think it was a controversial decision among some to adopt the family court rules, and we're glad that they did. This was, they do make a substantial improvement in court procedures.
And you, again, I want to repeat, because our listeners have asked, that it was House Bill 123 that you spoke of,
yes.
Tim, and that
House
they
Bill,
could call 5123, right?
House Bill 123, and the number to call is 502-564-8100, and that's the Legislative Research Commission's main number. You have to ask for your legislator, and if you do, they'll patch you through to their office, and then you can give them your statement about your support for the bill. And what happens to that statement is they have these little sheets. They're actually green, and everybody knows about the green sheets. And what I've been told, I don't know, I'm not a legislator, I don't know the truth of this. What I've been told is that within the halls of the legislature, 7 or 8 of those little green sheets are considered a groundswell of support because they don't get a lot of calls. So to them, it's significant that they're hearing, the people are taking the time to call them up and show support. If it's particularly if it isn't just an organized effort, but an individual who's attempting to do something, they seem to take that very seriously.
Well, thank you, Kay. Do you have any thoughts you want to make sure that our listeners are left with about your experiences in this area and your leadership?
Well, I would just kind of sum up what I think children need. It's a lot of people ask me, what do you do for children, or what's the secret? Well, I don't think there's any magic formula. As I said before, it's not a one size fits all problem or issue. But I have found that children need 4 things. They need to feel safe. They need to feel safe before anything else, any learning or any real growth can take place. They need to be protected. The second thing is, I think children need to be held accountable. All children, from a 2-year-old to the 18-year-old, they need to be held accountable and held to certain rules and certain standards. The third thing I think they all need is to be educated. All children need to be educated at whatever level is appropriate for them. And the fourth thing that they need is they need to know that somebody cares.
Well, those are really good maxims for us to consider. And I'm sure that you've tried to run your program, and I'm sure those who try to work with children would try to follow those maxims. Mom, I wondered, I think that it can be so hard when your child is, you're facing this and your family's under scrutiny, and you feel as though you almost described a setting in court where you felt like there were a lot of folks almost against you in that setting. Is that how you felt?
Oh, yes, definitely. I definitely felt like that. Instead of me being able as a parent to, say to my son, now this is what, as a parent, that I'm going to do to deal with this, I had to go into a mode of defending him. Every day that he missed school, I don't believe, and I don't care to say this, every single day that he missed school wasn't because of depression. Some of it was being a typical teenager. And on those days, I want to be able to say, as a parent, well, I'm going to ground you or whatever, And the court totally took that control away from me and put me in a position where I had to defend him, all the way. And it was like, we were bad guys over here in this corner, and they were, the people with authority, and you know, my voice didn't count whatsoever. So then there was nothing to be heard. You know, it didn't matter what documents that I had with me from a psychiatrist. It, you know, nothing mattered. So, yes, I did feel like that we were being sort of ganged up on, I guess, and that the control is totally being taken from the parents. And I would like to comment, if I could, real quick on what Tim said earlier. You know, it is all at the back end of it. If at the beginning of this, if there was more effort put in, like Kay was saying about the assessment, then, you know, maybe this could have gotten under control before it got to this point, rather than now this has all went to this point and all of a sudden now you've got attorneys and you've got, you know, you're in front of the judge and going to detention, and how much, you know, money does that cost, even if it wasn't affecting the child bad. That's just a bad way to deal with anything. You know, there needs to be more upfront effort put into preventing this to getting to that point than dealing with it after it's already got to that point.
I know that I live in Fayette County, and I know the police officers are now telling us they're on us to wear our safety belt, and they're going to be looking in our car windows at night to make sure we have them on so that we won't have wrecks, because the evidence, you know, would be that fatalities are so serious. And that's sort of what you and Tim and Kay are speaking of, that if we were to pay attention to these children and their needs, you know, earlier, and not see the court system as it's the emergency room, really. It should be seen that way, and we surely don't want everybody ending up in the emergency room. Is that a fair analogy?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that we could put more resources into those community-based types of programs, like Gateway and others that are around the state, to try to help these kids.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, yeah. Well, I want to thank all our speakers for being with us, and we really appreciate that. You can listen to the show on demand and go to the Children's Law Center website to find that site, that online site to go to listen to the show. We, again, appreciate your involvement today, and certainly if you're interested in helping further, as we indicated on this issue, if you had a concern about it, you could contact any of the speakers, Kay or Tim or the KYA, who's strongly involved in this. So thank you very much, Tim, Kay, and Mom.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
You too.
You too.